the network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Week, episode 86, recorded Friday, April 12th, 2013. A whole new world.
Ready.
AV Week.
Performing. Scan.
Week.
Online.
This is AV Week. It's time for AV Week, your weekly wrap-up of audiovisual news and information. My name is Tim Albright. I will be your tour guide for the next 45 minutes, an hour, 3 hour. It's a 3 hour tour, George.
It's yeah.
With us this week are two of my favorite people in the whole wide world. Let's do ladies first. Her name is Dawn Mead. AV Dawn. There's a reason I did that. There's a story at the end we'll tell you about. Her name is AV Dawn. Dawn Mead. She is the marketing and media coordinator at NetAV. How are you, ma'am?
Very good, thanks.
With us always is the disembodied voice of George Tucker. His name is George Tucker. Hey, Tucker Twos. He is the engineering coordinator for World Stage. How are you, sir?
All right. Good morning.
Yeah, it is morning. This is just different for us. This is me on coffee instead of, you know, tea. This week we're going to talk about is being nice being sexist? a piece by an old friend of ours named Jennifer Willard on the Rave blog. Also going to talk about 3D printing because it's really kind of hot and heavy now. National Association of Broadcasters from my old stomping grounds, NAB, was this week. The reason we're talking about it, though, on an AV show is the fact that they've come out with some really, really wicked things. And also, I'm going to talk about Hulu, if we get to that, and the fact that, somebody that bought MySpace and then, you know, lost it is looking to spend $500 million for them. But first, let's talk about controversy, shall we? Controversy. Isn't there a song called Controversy?
I think it's a Prince song.
Oh, yes. I love Prince. So this week, couched as a not very well seen video on Crestron's website was blogged by our friends over at Rave. And they basically said, you know what? Crestron has taken two different videos, and they did. They took some of their products and did a video comparing them side by side with an Extron product and an AMX product. And the Extron product they used was an Extron DXP. The AMX they went against was the Innova. The DXP, actually, technically from the Extron side, is an HDMI switcher, a flat-out switcher. And they compared it with their HDMD 8x2, which you can't figure out the numbers. That's a sort of a matrix, right? You can send it out two different ways. And if you watch the Crestron video, it appears that the Crestron switching is a little faster. It appears that it resolves some of the video issues a little better on one of the video switches that they did on the Extron side. I think they had a color issue in the Crestron video, and I understand this is kind of hard to follow because there's a lot of trons and there are two or three different videos. Well, Mr. Andrew Edwards, as he's wont to do, about this time last year, he wrote a nice little blog post that says, "Hey, nobody goes to trade shows," and then they went to Cedia, and then they went to Ubitech. Anyhow, NAB, which still confuses me. Writes a nice little piece and says, "Hey, you know what? These guys are being nefarious. They are being underhanded. Smoke and mirrors, I claim. Smoke and mirrors." According to Mr. Edwards. And so he has his engineers do the exact same sort of, not really, comparison. Let me kick it off with this, and I'll ask you guys first, and I will save my honest opinions and my final opinions until after you guys. Dawn, first of all, is this a fair comparison? And secondly, does it matter how fast we switch?
You know, I mean... not even getting into the fair comparison thing or how fast we switch thing, I think it's almost like a tempest in a teapot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, this video sat on Crestron's site and hadn't been really getting a lot of views. I hadn't even heard of it. I totally missed. I mean, I guess I just skimmed over that issue, but I totally missed Gary's blog about it. The first I heard about it was this giant email blast that we got from Andrew. Yeah. And it's like, if you're really that upset about it, why are you sending everybody over to look at it? Why are you giving them all of this? You know, I understand that, you know, even bad press is press, and there's no such thing as bad press because it's getting people talking about you. You know, maybe it's some big cry for relevance on all of their parts, but I just, it was like a non-story until it came into my inbox, you know? At the end of the day, your average user, I mean, unless you're in a broadcast setting or you know, something like that, that it has to be time sensitive, most times a couple extra seconds or whatever switching is not a big deal for most of my clients anyway. I can think of a couple situations, broadcast being one, and maybe like live viewing, like, you know, some of our government clients, remote viewing things happening, you know, in a battle zone or whatever. They might need quicker switching to go from one camera to another. But in the real world, who cares if it takes a couple extra seconds or, you know, a minute, you know, if it's too long, but everyone's sort of equal there. You know, it's not the end of the world. So I don't see it as a massive story other than now it's like this giant controversy again.
Yeah. And again, Extron's in there. George, Don actually raises a really good point. When you're doing live or broadcast or something that has to have almost instantaneous switching, I can see where a second or two would matter. But I'm going to ask a rather naive question here because I used to live in the world of broadcasts. I had never heard of Extron or Crestron or AMX, for that matter, in the world of broadcast. So, if you're in that world, you're not using these guys anyway, are you?
More likely, well, not for live presentation or live feed, but you would probably in some of your war rooms or some of your monitoring rooms or something of that nature. I could see that happening. But, I mean, the thing is that when you have enough money to spend on these systems and you are investing that kind of money, you want a system that's going to be, quote-unquote, first, glitch-free. Mm-hmm. So you don't see those little tear marks or any kind of little white sputters or sparks that come between switching. And having it as quickly as possible is, it's that instant gratification thing. And isn't that what people are paying for when you're buying something this expensive and impressive? So I can see that as a valid point. From the perspective of, hey, I paid a lot for this. It should work as well as I want it to and make toast, too. Right? I mean, so
yes.
That being said, I'm not quite sure what's going on in that video. I haven't been able to, you know, look at it as intensely as obviously the Extron folks did. But there is something funny there. I don't know if it's deliberate. I don't know if it matters at this point. We don't know the entire setup. I guess to continue this and make it even more so they get more views, they could produce a video that shows the entire setup or photographs of the actual connections. It might be a tempest in a teapot, but when you're getting to this level of comparing switching speeds or any shootout, it has to be very, very clear what you did and very, very clear how it's set up with a common system. Now, putting them together and making them equal may not have or may not change anything about the results, regardless of what Extron's did or Crestron's demo did. But knowing that everything is equal, it's a scientific mantra, right? Can you reproduce it? Is it reproducible? Then you've got more than just a theory. You've got a fact. And right now, we've just got a theory.
Well, and right now, yeah, and we have a couple different videos that, let's be honest, were produced in very different ways. The Crestron piece, you know, and again, I'm not making excuses for either. I have friends that work with both. I have, you know, positive feelings about both their products. But the Extron piece, you can tell, and this is from a video side, you know, an old video guy here, there weren't any cuts. It was a solid shot from start to finish. The Crestron piece did have some edits. There were some fades. There were some starts and stops. Why that was done, I don't know. I don't know if the gentleman who was doing the piece messed up some of his lines and they wanted to restart again. I don't know why, but there were definitely some edits to the video. And it's
interesting.
Yeah. It's unfortunate that it was, because it gives the other side the ability to say, see, look, see, they're being underhanded. Well, maybe not really. You know, maybe they just simply, the guy wanted to get his line right. Who knows? And the other part was the fact that the setups weren't exactly the same. They simply weren't. And there was a scalar in the Extron piece. There wasn't in the Crestron piece. And so from the Extron side, they should have emulated it exactly like Crestron did if they wanted to do, you know, look, see, this is really how it was. Well, no, not really, because you're adding pieces now, right? You're making it to where you guys are a half second faster.
Well, and one thing you need to consider, and this comes out of something George said, you know, he mentioned shootout. Well, there's a reason that we don't do shootouts at Infocom anymore. And that's everybody's quality has gotten so good, like on the projector front, that it was a diminishing return. There was no point. Everything looked fantastic sitting there. There were, yeah, you could get super picky and say this one's different from that one, but it's all sort of a level playing field. And I think with Crestron and Extron and AMX, you know, they each have their certain application or their certain setup where they work better than the others. But in a lot of ways, a lot of their products are sort of on the same level. I mean, we're not talking about amateur hour versus the professionals anymore. They're all very good companies with very good products. And to sit there and nitpick about a couple of seconds and will they have this piece in or they don't have this piece in, I mean, it's kind of, they're inventing it to make a difference. You know what I mean? It just, for your average user these days, it's kind of moot. I don't see, I go back to Tempest in a Teapot. I just don't see it being that big a deal until they made it a big deal.
Well, and see, the other thing is, the thing that is kind of screaming at me is who's not saying anything about it. AMX hasn't posted some big giant thing. Honestly, Crestron hasn't really posted any giant thing. They just put this out there 3 months ago, and they're not responding to this. It's, and again, not making fun, have a lot of friends there. They do a lot of good work. But it's the guys that, in my opinion, have kind of fallen by the wayside when it comes to digital, right? I mean, their big digital thing that they made a big deal about the last time that they were at Infocom, which was almost 2 years ago now, was the XTP series, right? This is going to be our, you know, twisted pair, one single wire, da-da-da-da-da. Anybody seen one of these in the wild? Is it shipping yet? Because I haven't gotten a notice on that.
No.
On their big stuff, at least. And that's what I'm getting at, is the fact that I think they're making it, Extron is making a big deal about it, because they may feel that they're being kind of sidelined. There's a reason that Crestron didn't compare it to their DM stuff, because that would totally be apples to oranges, right? They compared an HDMI switcher to an HDMI switcher. AMX and Crestron both, they're both working on HD-based T architecture. They're both doing really well with doing 300-plus feet for full HD with content protection and everything else. And Extron's just not there yet. And I think maybe that's some of what the reaction by Andrew is that, you know what, we're still viable, guys. We matter, and they don't really, unless you're talking about, you know, maybe, you know, still in the HDMI world. But when we're talking about HD over some sort of category cable, maybe that's what I'm feeling from them, is the fact that you're not it's not a fair comparison anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Next story. this week, we're going to mention this real quick. Crestron released this week that they have the first Crestron connected residential wireless controlled door lock. And this goes in my shades file for Crestron. George?
We've had this argument before. Shades are money. So,
I
think they would get into shades. So, I think that's a moot point. You've lost it. So, just move on. But
I refuse. This is Waterloo.
Okay. But the Crestron, I guess it's the first wireless, but I know that other companies have integrated with like the other major manufacturers of locks in the previously. I think Control 4 and even Savant has something.
Yeah.
I don't remember exactly. But this is a must have, though, because I recall this being one of the most requested things people were looking for. It sounds silly. It's not going to make you a lot of money, but it's one of those added on features that just seems to push people over the edge of buying. They wanted it. They want to be able to unlock and lock their door. They want to be able to monitor it and do that kind of stuff. And it's a win. I don't know how many they'll sell, but just simply having it is going to be a win for them, at least from a marketing perspective.
Don, a Crestron rep of mine put it to me like this, and I was poking fun at the shades, and he said, "You know what? It's the marketing position of you have one person to blame. Is it a valid thing when it comes to this door controller or this door lock, or is George right where you know this is one of the most requested features for a house?"
I can see where they're going with the one person to blame thing, but I just kind of giggled when I saw the story.
Thank you. I
would like one for my house. I think it's a great idea. But my first thought was, you know, and this is, again, old school thinking, well, how are you going to unlock your door when your touch panel's in the house? But, you know, with the remote, you pay extra for the iPad or iPod or Android, you know, phone control. I see where they're going with it. It does make sense. And everyone likes a clicker like they have for their car, for their house. But it just seemed so funny at first, you know, because you get in that old mindset of Amex and Crestron or installed panels. And, you know, if it's locked in the house, how are you going to get to it? I do have to totally disagree with you on the shades front, though.
Right.
Shades are a fantastic option for these guys. And I'm not at all in the resi world, but even just for like VTC suites in offices, you want motorized controllable shades to be able to control your environment to give a better image and a better just a better environment for the video conferencing. And the shades are an integral part of that. And when you're integrating an entire boardroom or conference room or video conferencing suite, you know, if you can get it just direct from that manufacturer that's doing the controlling, you know, I have controllable shades at my house on my AMX system. And it's, I had to use like, you know, Draper or whoever it was mm-hmm. we got the shade from, you know, and integrate it with that. But if they're selling the whole package, then in that case, I totally see it.
And
I'm not saying, still giggle about the door lock.
I'm not saying that shades are bad. Do not misunderstand. I just think that, you know what, they're doing control, they're doing video, they're doing audio. You can control your washing machine and your refrigerator. And I just thought it was silly. I don't know.
They want to be the one ring to control the
one
that
ring,
rules it all.
Yes,
you
they
know,
are. And we all know how that story
guys.
Ended.
There's still the profit. How many people have asked them, do you have
shades
that you can sell? What do you mean?
Who's the prophet?
Who's the prophet?
Sorry. Yes, I get the prophet. And it does, yes, it makes sense because it's something else to be able to control, just like lighting is. And they've been doing lighting for good Lord, however many years. And I get
it. And thermostat control and thermostat, all that.
Yeah, all of that. It still strikes me as funny. And the picture that they use on their website and the fact that they're doing the static shades, like, you know, Bowie's changes, you know, it's just, I don't know. They need to get different marketing people or something. I don't know. All right. Let's take over NAB for a second. National Association, easy for me to say, of Broadcasters was this week. NAB 2013 was in Vegas. It always is in Vegas. It will never, ever not be in Vegas. It's immensely huge. It's probably the broadcast version. No, it is the broadcast version of CES in size and scope and the number of people who are there. We mentioned that earlier. Extron is at NAB this week. I talked to an old buddy of ours from Kramer, actually, last week, and they were there this week. And so you've got a lot of AV people that are there. A lot of signal processing people and stuff, because that's, you know, like George mentioned, when it comes to the war rooms and the monitoring rooms, this is what these guys do on the back end. But you also have camera people. And what does cameras do? What do cameras do? They create content for the devices that we've been talking about. There is no content for. Don brought us a really good piece by Cindy Davis from Higher Ed Tech Decisions talking about 4K, 8K, I'm not going to say the other word, and cloud media storage. The other word is 3D. Dawn, one of the first lines that she uses is something that caught your eye's eye, is the possibility of affordable OLED.
Yes, and it makes me so happy. If you've ever listened to our podcast for more than 5 minutes, you'll know that Tim and I have both been kind of waiting for OLED in the real world for years now. And every time there's news about it, we get excited. And the fact that it might be affordable and I can have it in my living room, hopefully, I'm just giddy with joy. I'm giddy like a schoolgirl because it just makes me happy. But when I saw this article, the article headline, you know, that the link goes to just says 4K and 8K. But the email I got, the header was 4K, 5K, 8K, and two thoughts sprang into my brain. First was, my K goes to 11, you know, like a Spinal Tap, or the Ozzy Osbourne phone commercial. You know, how many bloody K are there? It we're constantly increasing that. And it's great to keep talking about increases in the resolution out there, but till we actually get it and have the content and the players, you can talk theoretically, you know, 10,000K. It's not going to matter. We need it in our hands, like the affordable OLED.
Yeah.
Just, you know, keep dreaming, but bring us actual things for my house. Yay.
Well, and that's the thing, George, is the fact that these guys are quickly, the iterations are quickly coming down in price, quicker than I think that I ever imagined they would, and quicker, I think, than the original 720p plasmas came down. I think I've told this story before. About 20 years ago, I had a buddy of mine that worked for Best Buy. Best Buy or Circuit City, I honestly can't remember at this point. And he had a guy come in and bought one of the first plasmas in the St. Louis area. Guy spent $20,000 for what was probably a 45, 50-inch plasma 720p. And it, you know, it was, it didn't stay at 20,000 for years, but it was there for, you know, for decades, but it was there for a number of years, and still it was in the 5 to 10 range even in the late 90s. And then, you know, slowly but surely the prices started coming down. When it comes to this 4K and 8K stuff, it almost feels like, you know what, it was just 2 or 3 months ago we were talking about the Sony OLED that they were touting for $25,000, and now that they're coming down even faster than that.
Yeah, because it's going to be an overnight success that took 10 years.
Let me think.
That's my simple answer to it. It's been around for so long and been in such different applications that the ability for it to be at the consumer level seems like it's an overnight success, but I think it's really been a very long, slow build-up. And they did it, well, I want to say they did it right. Well, we'll see, being Sony and all. But
but it's not just Sony, right? It's Samsung and some other displays, guys.
Right. You mentioned Sony, so I took a dig at them. I had to. It was there.
It was.
Yeah. Seriously, I think it's been an overnight success that really took a long time to come, and it's finally to the form factor that it can come into the residential consumer markets. And we just are just starting to see that rush in.
Yeah, George brings up a good point. All overnight successes take forever. And our problem is we're in the know. We've known about this technology forever. So to us, it seems like it's been taking forever. But if you were just, you know, Joe Consumer or Jane Consumer out there that, you know, you have a flat panel, ooh, and then all of a sudden it's like, wow, 4K OLED, where did that come from? And I can afford it? That's fantastic. You know, it's everything happens quicker nowadays in the media and in the public, but for people in the industry, you're always going to know about the R&D stuff way in advance and get excited and get disappointed. And
well, and see the vaporware for years and years and years that suddenly isn't vaporware anymore.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
George mentioned the dig at Sony. There's a CNET story on here. The reason I'm excited, and this is the other thing, is the fact that you've got 4Ks rolling out for $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Here's the thing with that, guys. I wasn't kidding. About 2 months ago, we did a story where the first OLED, this isn't OLED, but was it $20,000, $25,000? And I think the Samsung version of that was around $30,000. You've got 4K, and the other story, kind of in combination with this, is a Blackmagic production camera, a 4K production camera for basically $1,000, $995. There is something that has been in the works for, I personally know of about 5 or 6 years, and it may have been earlier than that, but one of the first production cameras to produce 4K was somebody called Red.
Mm-hmm.
And the body of it was $15,000. The mm-hmm. body. And if you know anything about cameras and this, that, and the other, you always know that the glass is traditionally the most expensive piece on the camera. So imagine what the glass, the lens, would be on a piece that starts at $15,000. So you're looking at about probably $25,000 to $50,000 for one camera to produce something in 4K. It dawned the fact that we've got displays that are sub 5,000, you know, barely, but they're at 5,000. You have production cameras that are right at $1,000, which, let's face it, even when like the GL1s and the XL1s from Canon came out, those were still $2,000 to $3,000. This is kind of an exciting time when just a couple of years ago we were saying 4K is great, we just need content, right?
Right. I think it's fantastic news, both the Blackmagic camera announcement and the Sony price decreases for the actual content showers, the viewers, the displays. Like you said, we've been talking about these higher resolutions for a while now, and we just haven't had anything. I think I said a couple weeks ago when I was on the podcast that I finally in the theater saw my first movie that said at the very end, you know, because I'm a geek that stays till the end, produced or shot on red cameras. Oh, yeah. So, you know, the Wizard of Oz movie, the new one, was actually shot on red. It was shot for 4K. That's fantastic, but that's the first one. And we've been talking about it, it seems like, for ages, you know, being insiders. So the fact that they've brought this sub-$1,000 camera out, the fact that they're bringing out these displays at around $5,000, which, you know, compared to a Best Buy or a, even worse, Walmart, you know, consumer display, that's still pricey. But what you're getting, the higher resolution and the image quality, you're absolutely right. It's very exciting, and it tells me that 4K and the Ultra HD type resolutions are going to be here to stay or get improved upon, because it's not just talk now. It's for reals.
George, what does this tell us when it comes to maybe the next generation of resolution about, you know, the displays and this, that, and the other, the fact that you have... Not consumer grade. I'm not going to, you know, diss. I've not held the Blackmagic piece, but when it comes to price points, right, a sub-$1,000 camera is relatively inexpensive when you're talking about production cameras. What does that tell us? The fact that you've got a relatively inexpensive production camera, and these, albeit $5,000 is not Walmart like Don said, but it's still not, you know, $20,000. What does that tell us about the kind of the next generation or the next steps for resolution for not just content creation but also display?
Well, I'd like to take a little bit of a different take on that. I don't know what it says about what the next resolution will be, but it's all about ecosystems.
Okay.
Maybe I'm going back to the graduate. It's all about plastic. It's all about ecosystem. You've got. It used to be that we said it was the adult industry that would drive the format of the new mediums, which was true. And to a small extent, I think it still is true. These kind of things will drive those people to say, hey, we can do it and produce it in these, just like they did in HD. But really what drove HD into massive acceptance, in my opinion, was the ability for homeowners, and at the slightly upper level, these two products, the camera and the Sony 4K, and their player that they have out now, or will have out soon, gives the ability of the average upper middle class tech geek to produce his own content. And when I see my own stuff in 4K, why wouldn't I want to see it with everything else? And I'll start searching it out. Right. So the quality I can produce will drive me to want, say, well, if I can do it, why aren't the movie theaters doing it? And this, that, and the other thing. So you get this sort of ecosystem of, we produce the players, there's a camera for it, we have a smart TV that lets you hook up into it. It's the Apple model of an ecosystem. And there are some other stories we're going to cover today, hopefully, in this, that show that as well. You build an ecosystem that's not extraordinarily massive, but that will allow that format or that new technology to take root in the home ownership or the, you know, whatever you're searching for.
Right. And at the very least, these inexpensive 4K cameras will improve the quality of our YouTube videos.
Well, that's exactly. The other thing, Dawn.
Cats in 4K is great.
Well, no. She kind of said that tongue in cheek. But here's the thing: you can upload in 4K now to YouTube. You can't stream it. You can download the video in 4K. So if you shoot in 4K, you can upload it to YouTube, and someone can download that and watch it on a 4K display if they so choose. You can stream, by the way, in HD. But you, to get to the 4K, you have to actually physically download it. You guys are right. The kind of the consumer end is now driving things again.
Mm-hmm. Now, this might be much ado about nothing, because we've heard this argument a lot. And I was just reading Andrew Robinson's blog about 4K. And a lot of his listeners or fans were commenting about how, well, 4K is not really a format. It's not a residential product, because in order to notice the difference, you have to be either enormous in image or really, really close. And who's going to sit 5 inches from a TV? All right, my kids do, but you and I are not going to do it, right? So there is a little bit of debate here.
Just
is it worth the money?
Why do they do that?
Who, kids?
Yes. Because mine do the exact same thing.
I think I read a Psychology Today study that showed about how they don't understand the difference between those two worlds. And being right next to it is sort of like being next to their friend or being next to whatever. And that's the intimacy. That's how they communicate. And they're still, that fourth wall doesn't exist for them, even if it is really a physical wall. And it takes time to learn it.
And what have we learned today? George Reed's Psychology Today. Okay. You guys are listening to AV Week. Thank you so much. You know what? I wouldn't tease you if I didn't love you. That guy right there is George Tucker, also with us, who suffers through on a time to time, is Dawn Mead. We'll talk about home, and we'll stay there for a second. A story by Electronic House is about that. This is from Grant Clauser, who I think we've had on a couple times, talking about a home getting an upgrade without drilling. And if anybody's ever either done renovation or you're in the resi market, your ears immediately perk up. George, when I first saw this, my immediate reaction was, holy crap, they did nothing but wireless, and that just scares the crap out of me.
Right, yeah. It was my first thought, too.
So how do they pull this off?
Well, yeah, I mean, and my first thought was wireless, and I long ago have labeled video over wireless in the home as Brundlefly. Mm-hmm. So it feared me. I'm like, no, don't keep pushing this. It's not time yet.
No.
But what they did is what I like to call topology morphing and retrofitting. So the retrofitting is that they went all Cat 5. They basically, where this piece basically pushes the universal remote product, which is actually a decent product from what I've seen, and I've actually seen it up close. And it's Cat 5 capability and the ability of people from, I think, outside of the home, like a dealer, to make updates and changes remotely, which is always beneficial and very innovative. The whole part of this is that the homeowner doesn't want, if they want to upgrade, they don't want this army of people in their house. They don't want bumps on the walls. They don't want drilling and having to replaster, especially here in the Northeast, where some of these bigger, older mansions, that's plaster. And that's an entirely different world of fixing and making right after you've drilled holes to run cables.
Mm-hmm.
But so they've ran Cat 5, which is minimal. They've ran it probably with the speaker cables or in some kind of conduit joints to do it. But the biggest one I saw was they were using some of the existing Cat 5 coax in the home with special modulators to send data over those.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's what I call the topology morphing, where you can get a certain degree of acceptable high definition over that, as long as it's short enough run. And that's a great answer. And this is the, I'm not here to make tons of money with my cable and bundlings. It's, I'm going to get the job done right. And it was still a decent job. What was it, $35,000, I think they said, total?
$35,000, yeah.
Yeah. That's not small potatoes.
Well, Don, in my real job, I work for a college that was, the original parts were built in the 1830s.
Whoa.
Let me say that again. 1830s.
You still have gas ports there, I bet.
We do. Yeah. You would, and ghosts, and I'll talk about that later. It was built as a women's college for back in the 1830s. And so what George is saying is right. It's plaster. So this can be, it's kind of exciting for people in, should be exciting in, for people in commercial as well, for, you know, retrofitting older structures.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, where I'm here in Maryland, D.C. area, you know, we've got a lot of federal buildings. You're not just talking plaster, you're talking marble, you're talking all kinds of surfaces that are just impossible to deal with on a regular basis. You know, a few years back, we did a sound system for a church that was in, it was originally a synagogue, and it was like the first or one of the first synagogues in the United States, which tells you how old that is.
Wow.
And it was all marble, and it was all, and they didn't want, you know, conduit or anything visible, but how are you going to get that? We're not going to drill this marble. Good God, you know? And so there's all kinds of challenges that something like this, if the stuff is already, you know, the coax or the whatnot is already in the walls, it's a fantastic solution. Now, the one thing that concerned me in the article was it did say some places he did have to use existing AC ducts to run some wiring. And when you're dealing in commercial, there's all kinds of, you know, plenum, non-plenum, and different local, state, federal regulations about what you can and can't run through your air systems. But I just think if it's possible to go wireless or with these minimal retrofit things, it's fantastic for both resi and commercial.
I would just buy plenum cable and put it wherever.
Well,
that's the whole idea behind plenum, isn't it?
The whole idea behind plenum is apparently, and I researched this several years ago, plenum doesn't burn as quickly as non-plenum.
Right.
However, once you do manage to get it burning, apparently it's more toxic than the non-plenum, yes, at least some
really?
Flavors of it. So okay. It's really a no-win solution if you have to go through the air,
supposed to be low smoke, low,
yeah, yeah, low smoke, yeah.
Yeah.
Low smoke, low toxicity, but once it gets burning full scale, get out.
Yeah.
See, George, this is why we should have wireless. No wires.
I know.
100% plenum.
No, what we need to do is we need to make plenum exposed wiring the architectural thing to do. Got to go retro industrial. You got that going. Man, oh man, can we do a lot of stuff.
Jeez. All right. We're going to tackle Samsung because we haven't talked about them this week, and I feel kind of naked not doing so. We've talked about them a lot the last couple weeks. And this is the latest one that comes from Best Buy. They're going to have, they're calling them Samsung Experience Centers inside Best Buys. George, this sounds an awful lot like the Magnolia, if you guys remember that from Best Buy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Why? Why are they doing this? I mean, is it just to be Apple and to lay claim to, you know, being the I guess the Microsoft now to Apple when it comes to consumer electronics?
I suppose that is partly the answer. Yes, you've got two ideas when you want to branch out into more than just phones, or you need to go horizontal as well as vertical in your growth. Right? There are two ways. One, you bring the people to you. Or you go to the people. I think this is the example of the latter. Where are people buying stuff? In the big box stores. Some of them are. Or at least they're looking at them in the big box stores.
I was gonna say, right? Really?
Yeah, okay, yeah, you got me. Well, but they're still there. They're still existing.
Yes.
This is an idea of saying, you're going there. Why not try to capture your eyes while you're there? I think the inevitable transition is for them to make a Samsung a la Apple store. But that leap from in-house store to your own store may be short, but it is fraught with many difficulties that make it very hard to get there. It's sort of like trying to go over a very small, rapid river. It may look easy, but if you put your foot in wrong, man, you're going to be swept down the river for a little while. That's what I think they're really doing, is trying to get their eyes. They're really getting onto Apple. They're nipping at their heels, if not now ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is their next step, is, okay, what's the next growth level? Get it in store. Get it so that people come to us to buy our stuff.
John Georgia makes a point. Georgia, good Lord. George makes a point.
Georgia.
Okay, that was weird. screw it. What is Samsung doing? Please save me from myself.
I'm not sure what they're doing, because isn't Best Buy kind of dying? I mean, isn't that, maybe this is like a last-ditch effort on Best Buy's part to bring some value to their stores again. I mean, coming at it from the different point of view of not, you know, from Samsung's point of view, but from Best Buy, like, oh my God, we're getting showroomed out of business by Amazon and everybody else. You know, people come in, check out our stuff and buy it elsewhere. Like, let's bring in a name. Let's bring in a brand that's really going to do something. Magnolia wasn't it. I'm sorry. You know, and their little home theater section in Best Buy was really only good when what was that basketball team from, I can't even remember where they were from, some university basketball team that found out where they were seated in the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
Because they missed their flight or something. So they all went into Best Buy and like sat down and watched the live,
yeah,
you know, like that's really what those things are for. Nobody, you know, they're for sitting while your husband or your wife is shopping and your feet hurt, you know?
So,
I mean, that's really kind of where Best Buy is. You know, they've been sold and they've been bought and they've been revamping, and they're going to go to smaller stores, they're going to go to bigger stores, and it's been in flux for a couple of years now. I have a soft spot for Samsung. I love them. Maybe there are other people that feel the same way, and by putting them in the Best Buys, that'll sort of revitalize that brand a little bit.
Okay.
And like you said, it does then give them a physical foothold to compete against the Apple stores. But again, if you're not one of those I people, the Apple stores mean nothing other than go to make fun of the geniuses, you know.
That is true. And just so you know, we all need to think good thoughts for the guys at Samsung because, well, let's be frank, they're in South Korea. So that's all
true.
I'll say about that. Crazy little guy has his finger on a button. From NPR, we should have mentioned this when we talk about NAB, but broadcasters were discussing one thing this week at NAB, how to get into the zero TV crowd. And I have to credit George for giving me this one because I didn't even realize this moniker was out there. Nielsen, actually. And Nielsen's the company that tracks, you know, what the popularity of shows. They introduced this a couple years ago as people who don't get TV. They're not subscribers to satellite or cable. And about 2 million a couple years ago, and it's 5 million now. 5 million people who are basically cord cutters here. Dawn, is there anything that people can do or the broadcasters can do to grab these people back in? Because once you've cut the cord, there's an awful lot of savings and there's an awful lot of freedom when it comes to, you know, your own making your own choices, I guess, as to what content you're consuming.
Well, I mean, the broadcasters, they need to look at the new model. They need to look at where people are. Those of us that still are TV owners or TV subscribers, we're not just watching TV. We're multi-screening. We're watching TV while using a tablet or a laptop or a phone or all three. So the whole just sit and watch what comes on one of the five channels thing, that's over. That's history, you know? And if you're going to remain viable, you have to provide content that can be streamed. You have to provide content that can be downloaded, that can be watched anywhere on your own time. You have to make it, you know, DVR friendly. Don't send out spoilers and don't be that guy. I mean, you know, and so there's a whole massive like mind shift that some of these broadcasters have to get to if they intend to remain viable. And, you know, some of the content producers, some of the studios that are making the shows and things like that, they're starting to get it. Several of the cable networks, the paper cable, they're getting it. HBO Go is fantastic. You know, I realized the other night that my satellite provider now has the ability. I can set my DVR and record things at home or stream things on my phone wherever I am.
Wow.
I was out to dinner and I was like, oh, man, I wanted to set the DVR. Wait a minute. And I sat there in a restaurant across town, set my DVR to record something. And if I had wanted, if we weren't in the middle of a restaurant, I could have streamed it to my phone and watched
it
live.
Awesome.
You know, so some of them are starting to get it. As for, you know, ABC or you know, WMAR or whatever your local whatever is, they're going to have to come up with a way to, they're going to figure it out.
Yeah.
They're either going to figure it out or they're just going to close. And it'll be the end of an era. But, I mean, that's where we are now. You know, it's 5 million now. But how many of those people that aren't in that 5 million are like me and are doing, you know, streaming things when they're not home? How many of them are time delaying and time shifting their things? How many are, you know, thinking about cutting the cord because they're doing four things at once with multi-screens? You know, it's definitely where things are going in a lot of ways. And as the baby boomers age even further and begin dying off and Gen X and Y and what is the new in the millennials and the Gen C, I think they were calling it, something I read recently. As they come of age, this is where they're going to be. They're not going to have landlines for phone, and they're not going to have old school TV, whether it's broadcast, cable, or satellite.
George, Don makes a good point when it comes to, you know, this number is going to keep growing. In 2005, there was a study that was done by Nielsen, and they track how many actual viewers for traditional broadcast over the air and cable. The number peaked in 2005. So. And ever since then, you can see it just kind of, it's not a precipitous decline. I'm not saying, you know, the sky is falling. However, there is a decline. So these guys have got to find something to do. And like Dawn's mentioned, doing things like giving you the ability to stream on your devices and fishing where the fish are, to borrow a phrase, is something they're going to have to do, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the same as a couple of shows ago. We talked about the Aereo TV, those little mini antennas that they receive and then stream to the their subscribers. They just won a major court case saying they could do it, even though the networks didn't want it. They're not seeing their old model in a way that they should, meaning, and I mucked that up, but the broadcasters are really fighting hard. Even the cable companies are fighting very hard for an old model of revenue that nobody wants to do, and they're forcing people to stick to it, and they're going to get they're going to lose the battle in the end. And part of this, I think, is their own success coming back to haunt them. Cable TV launched, there was 100 channels, just like the Bruce Springsteen song, and nothing's ever on. But what it's done is, just like the internet has allowed us to do with certain things, is focus in on those channels and those things that we want, even though we have to buy them as a whole package rather than a la carte, which is the crux of the issue here. We can focus on what we want. So cable gave us the ability to find channels that played the things that we liked whenever at a common time. And then DVRs let us record those and watch them whenever, repeated viewings, and in different times and in different places. This is just the next evolution, and it's part of what they established. They just don't like to admit it. It's the next step, and they got to go with it, or they're going to die.
Yeah.
Right. And to that end, I mean, if you look at the history of broadcast television in America, you know, we started, there were no commercials. You had the GE Humor Hour or whatever, and you would have entire chunks of content created solely and funded solely by this sponsor or that sponsor. And it was almost like some of the immersive or the, you know, what is it? Where they put the product placement advertising that we have now, but to an extreme. And then they moved from that model to the let's put commercials in between things model. And then they moved from that model. Now then they had the product placement stuff that we have now, plus that, you know. And frankly, I think that the consumers of all the content are the ones getting hosed, because back in the day, you had just product placement or just the commercial, but everything else was free. Now we're paying for satellite or cable, and we have to watch commercials, and we have product placement. And it's like, some people are lining their pockets big, and I'm sure they don't want to see the end of that gravy train. But, you know, it's really the viewers are the ones getting hosed. And it's like, let's scale it back. We can stream or purchase on Amazon Prime or HBO Go or whatever, and we can just watch the show and whatever product placement might be in the show. But that's, you know, and it's getting back even to an earlier model in a new way.
Who does the Game of Thrones?
HBO.
Which channel is that?
HBO.
Is it HBO?
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah.
What's the other one then? AMC has one. What does AMC have? Something very popular.
Walking Dead and stuff.
I think he was on Bloomberg Radio a couple of weeks ago, the CEO, where they don't actually stream that, do they? And I believe a lot of those shows don't, because he said, we are dedicated to the revenue model of our partners, i.e. the cable companies and those who will cable channels who will rebroadcast and buy the syndication rights to these shows. So that model's still being put forward by new channels that are breaking new ground, that are getting lots of people to come in and watch, but they're still doing this even though people are now starting to stream them. It's a tough fight that they're just not seeing the forest for the trees. Yes, there'll be loss of jobs and revenue will be reduced in certain ways, but come on, guys.
Okay, but here's the thing though, George. You've got that group of people over there. But then you have people who are like the Netflix of the world, who are making deals with Kevin Spacey. And if anybody's a subscriber to Netflix, you can watch an entire season of something called House of Cards that was produced and stars Kevin Spacey. The only place you can see it is on Netflix. It was never aired on a traditional broadcast network, cable or over the air. The only place you can see it is on Netflix, and they released it en masse. And you can watch episode one through episode whatever the other end is. They also did the same thing. They're doing the same thing with a quirky little show that used to be on Fox called the Bluth Family. That name, what am I?
Arrested Development.
Thank you. Arrested Development. Same thing. They're recreating that, and they're reviving that show. And the only place you can see it, again, is on Netflix. And so there are competing models here. Advertising is a $130 billion industry. Currently, the people who get the lion's share of that is broadcast television. And I don't understand. I still don't understand why that internet and internet media in general, and I'm not saying that because, you know, because we do this, but just, you know, TV and YouTube and stuff like that, people haven't gone there, because, again, you need to advertise where the people are.
Right. So. Well, and also to that point, you know, yeah, there are some places like HBO Go now for subscribers, but there are places that they won't let you stream the episodes, or you can stream them months later, so you've missed everything. But if you look at the news from April 2nd, April 3rd, April 4th, right after the Game of Thrones premiere, Over 1 million people watched Game of Thrones illegally. It set a piracy record for streaming video just this, you know, the past week or so for the season premiere, because they're not doing a live stream, or they're not doing a Hulu, or they're not doing providing it where the people are and where the people want it. So,
well Dawn, I would even go a step further with that, because I'm a huge fan of Game of Thrones, the books and the shows. I don't have HBO. I have no desire to have HBO. I would buy this season on Amazon or on iTunes right now if they would do what most broadcasters do, which is they release it the next day.
Right.
But they don't. They shift it an entire season. I can go out and buy season two now, all I want. But the reason that it broke records for piracy was the fact that there's no place to see this online legally for a whole year.
Mm. Right. Well, and actually, the one article that I'm looking at right now from The Guardian, the UK newspaper, because Game of Thrones premiere was the most pirated show, Game of Thrones was the most pirated show of 2012 of all shows that were pirated, and then it broke a record for pirating with their season premiere. After the season premiere ran a week or so ago, HBO started making noise that, okay, maybe we're going to let HBO Go, their streaming solution, be available without a cable TV subscription.
You're kidding me.
I'm looking at the article right now. They're working on it. It isn't for real yet. It's still kind of talk at this point, but they're starting to make noise that maybe this is not impossible, that maybe they'll make HBO Go bundled with internet service the way HBO is currently bundled with cable. So if you get internet, you could also pay the extra couple of bucks for HBO Go. It's still in talks, but
totally do that.
Some of them are starting to get it.
I'm actually writing a blog piece right now. I've got a couple calls in and some talking with actually MLB, Major League Baseball, because they're one group of people that get it, right? From my opinion. This is totally my opinion. This is not anything fact. But you can pay, I think it's like $120 or $130 a year to watch any game from any broadcaster. So I'm in St. Louis, so big Cardinals fan. If you're watching the Cardinals and the Cubs, you can watch it from the Fox Sports Midwest side, or you can watch it from the WGN side, which is the broadcasters for the Cubs.
Right.
You can do it on your any tablet. You can do it on multiple set-top boxes, whether that is the Apple TV, or there's a Roku, or there's an app on the Xbox, and there's an app, I believe, on PlayStation. And they get it, right? You can, for a fee, again, I have no problem paying the fee, but just let me do it and let me watch it when and where I want.
Right.
And I'm comparing that in the piece I'm writing against NFL, who could charge as much and probably more for people who are these disparate fans. Again, I'm in St. Louis, but I'm a Chicago Bears fan. I have friends around here who are Denver Broncos fans, for crying out loud, who would pay, and some of them do pay, $500 a year for, what's the DirecTV NFL ticket.
NFL ticket, yeah.
You give me that in an internet form, right? You give me that in a streaming form, and give me an app on my Roku or you know, Apple TV or what have you, I think they would go gangbusters. But they've got these, I don't know. I don't know if it's backward thinking, or there may be contractual things that none of us know about that they just can't get there from here.
I can tell you this much, they'd make bank just off of people like me that are in mixed marriages that, you know, even if you bought the NFL Sunday ticket, one spouse is watching their game on the TV, and we're over in the corner with a bad stream from an overseas pirate trying to watch our game, you know, and it's all fuzzy and you have to watch commercials for something in Australia while you're trying to watch, you know, your blessed Steelers play in Ravens country. But not that I'm bitter.
You realize that you're going to have an entire season of just heck because they have a trophy now. So
they have,
or another trophy.
Two
I shouldn't total. Say now.
We
I
have six.
Say,
yes. Just saying.
there it is. All right, a couple real quick, and we'll end up here. George is all hot and bothered about 3D printing. I am too, but he's more so. From Engadget, it's a really cool. It's a speaker that has been printed on a 3D printer, and they glow with there's LEDs in there. George, first of all, have you gotten a 3D printer yet?
I have access to one of a friend of mine who I gave a little money to, yes. Well, but it's not my own yet.
I think Dawn
and it's still one of the layered ones, you know, substrate stuff. But
I think Dawn and I should buy one for your birthday, which is Sunday. So happy birthday.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
He's 25. Continue.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. And all kidding aside, this is kind of cool, and this is just kind of the next generation and another development in this technology, right?
Absolutely. I mean, what we're starting to see, and I think this goes hand in hand with another article we were looking at called Hacking Changes Products, in which we're reaching a critical mass now with 3D printing, which we cover a lot, by the way, on our DIY show, also on the AV Nation Network, that we can make nice. What we want and what we need. We're very near that time where we can make these products, maybe in association with another manufacturer's products, but that we can modify these things to our needs or aesthetics even, and make remarkable things. These are cute little speakers. Okay, they're not the nicest things in the world for a high-end home, but the potential there to make what you need days before the project goes in is just a remarkable concept for me. It's hacking the system. It's hacking products to make them better. We're not waiting for the next revision from the manufacturer. We're making it ourselves. It's no longer these extreme DIYers doing it. It's you and me modifying our stuff and saying, that's okay. I can modify it. It's okay to alter this thing. And I am so anticipated the next 5 years that we might be able to do that or take an existing product, use a 3D printer, and make it absolutely perfect for the install we're doing.
Well, and Dawn, this could also go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say what you were going to say, but this also ties into that whole changing the way people operate. You know, we're watching TV where we want to and when we want to. We're also we've become very much, you know, if you look at Lifehacker, if you look at Instructables, eHow, the innovation level of people in America or in modern society, even not just in America now with the internet and everything, it's amazing where we are compared to where we were just a few years ago. You know, when I was a kid, you wouldn't even dream of doing half the stuff that we just do as a regular course of the day. You know, Lifehacker says, try this weekend, and we do, and it's like awesome. And you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years ago, it would have been like one clever guy in the Midwest does something and like nobody hears about it unless he writes a book or gets famous for building it.
Yeah.
So I think it's remarkable, and 3D printing and I even found there was not a TED talk, but an Ignite talk by a 9-year-old autistic kid in Arizona who is a big 3D printing fan. And he actually in his talk says where to go to get a build it yourself 3D printer kit, and you build your own 3D printer, and then you 3D print things. And this 9-year-old kid with autism is wearing glasses that he printed himself, and he has a whistle that he printed himself, and he gives you instructions in the little 5-15 minute talk, whatever, where to find patterns for things and where to find, you know, drawings that you can use in your self-built 3D printer. I mean, it's just amazing that, you know, little kids can do this now. So why can't we? It's just a whole new world we're in.
Yeah, it is. It's very cool.
Yes.
All right. Last but not least, from an old friend of mine, from an old friend of ours, Jennifer Willard wrote a piece that actually Dawn was in the process of writing at the same time.
So I didn't.
So you didn't. Backstory is this: is President Obama referred to another official as being by far the best looking, quote unquote, by far the best looking attorney general. It's true. Come on. End quote. The attorney general in question was a woman. So the Jennifer Willard writes a piece. And here's, I'll start with you, Dawn, because ladies first, you know, and I'll just keep going with this. Joanne Bamberger wrote a piece, and Jennifer quoted her, said, it's time to make a pact. From now on, if you are in a professional setting and you are thinking in your head, now that is one attractive man, woman, person, employee, colleague, business associate, dog, pig, whatever, this is what you must do from this day forward. Keep it to yourself. Dawn? Let's ask Jennifer's question first. Is being nice being sexist?
Well, the initial question is being nice being sexist comes about because the same day the story broke about President Obama referring to Kamala Harris as the best looking attorney general, an article came out from Scientific American that was proving that even commenting on someone's appearance or nice compliments towards women can impact the way they're treated in a professional environment. I.e., even if they're, you know, doing great work or whatever, by commenting on their looks in some way or complimenting them in a strictly gender-based way, you're influencing the way they are perceived by other coworkers and the way they are treated. So by making a point of their appearance, or, you know, the article mentioned an obituary that had been in, I believe, the New York Times, of a woman, and it said about, you know, the obituary read about, you know, was a great mother and always had time to bake cookies and give a snuggle to her kid, and she was also active in the aeronautics or missile development and it was someone that was a heroine of World War II, and she was like big on some of the missile development that was used in winning that war. And they said, could you imagine if Albert Einstein, who was also on the missile project, you know, or some of the other guys that were on the missile project, if their obituary read, you know, he always took time to bake and tuck him in, and they wouldn't do that. They talk about their achievements first, you know, and say they were missed by their family. But the idea that the gender plays a role in how we're perceived, even if we're being nice, is where that article was coming from. And while I'm normally not a super PC gal, if you've listened to this, you know this. so I don't take offense, you know, if you say I look great, hey, thanks, you know, that's awesome. I'm a girl, treat me that way. But it was interesting that there was actually research proving that women are treated differently after even a polite comment. And so that was where the juxtaposition was. I disagree with Joanne Bamberger saying that, you know, if you think someone is attractive or looks nice today or whatever, keep it to yourself. I think that there's politeness, and I think that there's room in the world for compliments without getting overly PC. But I also think you need to be aware that sometimes your words have consequences you might not be aware of. You know what I mean?
That makes sense.
So I kind of had mixed feelings about the whole thing, because it was it was just interesting. It made me think a lot, being not a super PC gal, you know, and I'm in a male-dominated industry. I'm one of the guys half the time. But at the same time, it's something you never really realized. And this Scientific American study, they did the research and said, oh, my gosh, wait, look at that. You know, you don't have to be a pig to inadvertently be sexist.
And that right there is the valid point, is that you don't have to. And you cannot even be, you know, you may not eventually be the one who is the sexist in that instance. You could cause someone else to. So, George, should you and I even comment on this?
Well, I mean, yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. Here's my question. It really comes down to understanding, where is the line between nice and ick?
Okay.
And it's a tough line. But there is something to be said when someone comes in and you go, wow, you look great in that suit. Is it sexist? Is it sexual? Or is it just a nice comment like, that's your look? You look great like that. It all depends on the context and who's saying it and what they hope to achieve out of it, right? Unfortunately, I think there's too many people who are looking for the more salacious side, and that's all their brain connects to on it. And sometimes that salacious side is perception more than intent. And there's got to be an equal balance. I mean, the article you say about the woman saying she was remembered, she always had time for baking, I don't know whether or not that's what she actually said. I'd like to be best remembered for what I did for family. You never know. That may be what her thing was. And then, yes, I did this cool thing. It probably wasn't, but you see where I'm getting at, is that we have to understand that the hard red lines, they're not necessarily there. What the president said, I think, was just silly. I think he was trying to be something more, and it just came out completely wrong. I'm giving him the benefit of doubt, mind you, but we have to be very careful. I mean, look, we still have booth babes at freaking shows. Can we solve that first?
What's a booth babe?
Yeah, exactly.
I have never seen
there's
these
somebody who gets in the way of the thing you're trying to actually go for.
And see, that's an area where Jennifer and I and several of the other women in AV, we've had this debate the past couple of years that's been an issue that, you know, personally, I don't have a problem with booth babes as long as they're clearly identified as such. Put a showgirl in your booth. Put a girl in a bikini in your booth, whatever. But don't put a hot chick in your booth that you hired because she's a hot chick and put her in your company shirt and have her interfacing with the customers as though she worked for you. Because to me, that's more offensive, by them pretending that they know what they're talking about or looking like they could work there. And then when you talk to them, they're like dumb as a stump. And then that brings all the other women in the industry down. But if it's a showgirl, hey, you're in Vegas, whatever. It's a showgirl, right? That's my view. Some of the other women in AV, they don't see it that way. But it's a matter of perspective, you know.
Don makes a good point. The last time that Infocom was in Vegas, was in Orlando. Somebody, and I don't remember who at this point, and I apologize, they had hired the Orlando Magic cheerleaders to do one of the games. You had to shoot a basket to get a prize at their booth. But they were clearly the Orlando Magic cheerleaders. Right. And they weren't, it wasn't, you know, anything gaudy or anything, but they were in Orlando Magic t-shirts and basketball shorts, and that's what they did, right? That they were not quote-unquote representatives of this company. You would not expect to walk up to them and say, hey, tell me about your product. You would walk up to them and say, hey, can I win something? So.
Right. Mm. And again, for the past couple of years, kudos to Crestron. I will come right out and name names. Kudos to Crestron, because when they have their Crestron party for the Crestron dealers, you know, traditionally when they throw these parties, they always hire some sort of hoochie entertainment, whatever. The past two or three years now, when you go to leave the show floor at Infocom and go to the Crestron party, they've had hot chicks holding the signs, and they've hired hot guys to hold signs as well to direct you. So all the women in AV and all the alternative men in AV, you know, right on. There's eye candy for you too. If you're going to be sexist, be equally sexist.
I appreciate you noticing me, Dawn.
Yeah, well, you know, those booty shorts are hard to miss.
Oh, wow. That image will stick with you all week.
With that mental
week.
Image in your brain now.
Oh, God, I have to go now.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have. Thank you guys so much for joining us. That woman right there is one of my favorite women. Her name is Dawn Mead, AV Dawn. You can find her on blogs. Well, you tell people how they can find you, ma'am.
If you're interested in my blog, which is desperately in need of an update, it's avdawn.com. If you're interested in learning a little bit more about my integration company, we're NetAV, NetNET-AV.com on the internet. And if you are coming to Infocom in Orlando and want to learn about social media, take my class. I'm teaching a class there. So look up social media for small businesses in the Infocom University this year.
Yay. I'm so happy for you. That is so cool. And also with us is the birthday boy. His name is George Tucker. Tucker Twos, tell folks how they can find you, sir.
If you're on social media, it's Tucker Twos. You can find me there. Tucker Tuesday on TypePad. And I have a couple of articles just published in Tech Decisions about AV and IT. Go read, go comment. Get me some members.
Go.
Right on.
All right.
Thank you.
If you would like to follow me, it is TD, Tim David Albright, but more importantly for everybody here, go by the website. They spent an awful lot of time for it. I say they because I didn't have a thing to do with it. It's avnation.tv, avnation.tv. You'll find this podcast as well as our monthlies. George mentioned the DIY Live Life. We have an education-focused show, a brand new one about control. It's called A State of Control with Steve Greenblatt, our old buddy Rich Fragosa, and a couple more. And I will warn you folks, this month's episode of that show is about who owns the code at the end of a job. And I'm putting on my big boy panties and my iron underwear because I have a feeling that I may stir some things up. So,
ending with controversy like we started.
Yes,
with controversy.
Exactly. So yeah, go by the website, avnation.tv. We've got Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and all that. But start there at the website, if you would, please. Avnation.tv. Thanks so much for listening. That is all the time we have for AV Week.